Hello, my name's Dave Emery. In this next half-hour segment, we're going to update a number of different stories that we've covered or that we've at least touched on in some fashion or another over the years, or introduce some new subject material in some cases. As I speak on the evening of Sunday, February 14th of 1999, the impeachment brouhaha has finally abated. And in the course of the focus on the Republican right wing during the course of the abortive removal of Bill Clinton, there has been some focus finally on some of the connections between the Republican Party and overtly fascist elements, including an overtly racist organization that is sort of the successor, I guess one could say, to the old white citizens councils, and that is the Council of Conservative Citizens. This is not a subject that I'm going to go into at any great length, because it has fortunately been covered by other media voices, both mainstream and progressive. However, I thought I would underscore a particular point. What we're going to do now is to take a look at a number of articles from the latest issue of the Searchlight magazine. Specifically, we're going to take a look at the Searchlight's issue of February of 1999. The Searchlight, by the way, is a British anti-fascist publication, not to be confused with the American Spotlight, its opposite ideological number. The Spotlight has a very similar name, but a diametrically opposed ideological viewpoint. The Searchlight can be contacted at 37B, as in boy, New Cavendish Street, C-A-V-E-N-D-I-S-H, London, William 1 Mary 8 Jolly Roger. That's London, W-1-M-8-J-R. The worldwide website for the Searchlight is www.s-light.demon.co.uk. Once again, the website for the Searchlight is www.s-light.demon.co.uk. Their email address is editor@s-light.demon.co.uk. And in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to access a number of stories from the latest issue of the Searchlight. In the Searchlight on the States section, there is an article about the Conservative or the Council of Conservative Citizens and some of its overtly racist and fascist connections. Bear in mind that Senator Trent Lott and Representative Bob Barr, among others of the Republican pro-impeachment contingent have, or pro-removal contingent, I should say, also pro-impeachment, have had dealings of one type or another with this organization. And in Trent Lott's case, he was deeply involved with it. A point is made here in a section called Lying of a Different Kind, talking about some of the many connections that the Council of Conservative Citizens has. And this is an organization that defends the Confederacy and slavery and could be very fairly called overtly fascist and racist. A point is made here talking about the many associates and fellow travelers of this organization. And the CCC recently published a discussion paper, unquote, by a leading officer in William Pierce's National Alliance, Robert Demarais, or Demarais, capital D-E, capital M-A-R-A-I-S. Well, the National Alliance of William Pierce is arguably the most important domestic Nazi group, and its publishing arm, National Vanguard Books, has published, among other titles, the Turner Diaries, authored by William Pierce himself, and also the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk by Randolph Calverhall that I've accessed many times over the years. That's obscure text, which I believe is far more than the novel it purports to be. I believe it's a blueprint for what is going on and what is going to go on, not unlike the Turner Diaries itself has proved to be. Serpent's Walk is about the SS going underground, which they did, building up a huge capital organization, which they did, the Bormann organization that I've alluded to many times, and buying into the American opinion-forming media. They infiltrate the U.S. Army, and after a biological warfare attack with genetically engineered viruses of ostensibly Russian origin wipes out much of the American population and much of the world's population, the Nazi group then takes over the United States and the rest of the world in the the mid-21st century. I make the point that one of the leading officers in the National Alliance had a discussion paper published by the CCC, because with the connections between the CCC and the Republican Party itself, I think one should not fail to note that something as seemingly peripheral or seemingly obscure as Serpent's Walk and the other titles published by National Vanguard Books are not to be taken lightly. Again, it might appear to be an awfully far cry to talk about the Republican Party on one hand and the National Alliance and Serpent's Walk on the other, and I can fully appreciate that my discussion of that text may appear to be irrelevant or obscure to some people. However, I am citing the connections between the CCC and the Republican Party and between the CCC and the National Alliance, whose publishing arm National Vanguard Books puts out Serpent's Walk, in order to underscore that these are not peripheral things and they are to be taken very, very seriously. I would also note, as I'm recording this on the evening of February 14th of 1999, that this past week, Jerry Falwell, one of the main cogs in the Christian right, itself a driving engine for the Republican Party, has focused his withering blast on a television character called Tinky Winky, alleging that it's some sort of gay role model for young kids. This has been the subject of much merrymaking in the media. It's fairly ridiculous in and of itself. However, the absurdity of Falwell's comments, I think, should not obscure the deadly fanaticism of the Christian right. And even though the attempt to remove Bill Clinton has failed, I don't think people should in any way relax their vigil on what is going on in this country, because the Republican Party could be fairly described as a fascist political party, and it is in no way in remission, so to speak. And when one looks at the connections between the CCC and some of the driving figures to remove Bill Clinton, and in turn between the CCC and the National Alliance, and when one sees leading figures of the Christian right wing, itself arguably the most important element of the Republican Party right now, such as Jerry Falwell going to the extremes that he has gone to attack a fairly silly children, well, I shouldn't say silly, but a children's television character, one should not lose sight of what a bunch of absolute freaks these people really are. They are true fanatics in the most literal sense of the word. They are altogether dangerous, and the public and mediated merrymaking over Falwell's attack on Tinky Winky should not obscure the unblemished fanaticism that Falwell and his type and the Republican Party themselves represent. Hell, they don't represent it. That's what they are. And people should be very, very, very much on the alert for forces of that kind. Fascism is rearing its head elsewhere around the world. In late 1998, I recorded a half-hour segment entitled Russian Fascism, and I also recorded a segment in May of 1998 detailing the rise of overtly fascist and Nazi groups in the former Soviet Union and Russia. In the Searchlights issue of February of 1999, there is an item that would appear to be incredible to people familiar with the history of the Second World War, or even people who were familiar with the political attitudes, or at least the official political attitudes, in the former Soviet Union. An indication that political amnesia is certainly not limited to the United States and other Western countries. Political amnesia would appear to be taking hold in a big, big way in Russia and other former republics of the Soviet Union, or the other republics of the former Soviet Union. This is an article called Scum on the Surface of the New Russia, and anyone familiar with the history of World War II will be stunned by what they're about to hear. A Russian Orthodox priest has helped veterans of the SS Legion Norwegian, the Norwegian SS Legion, to dedicate a monument to themselves in the small Russian town of Krasnoye Selo, that's Krasnoye, capital S-E-L-O, near St. Petersburg. Several well-known former members of the Waffen-SS and old Nazi collaborators from Norway were present at the ceremony. The monument was erected at the Blue Church in August. Hitler's former butchers had claimed they wanted, quote, peace and reconciliation, unquote, with their former enemies in order to obtain the permission of the Russian Orthodox Church and inveigle the local priest to unveil the stone and give it his blessing. Skipping down, Krasnoye Selo, and I may be mispronouncing that, was the location of the Norwegian Legion's headquarters when the Nazi hordes encircled Leningrad during the war. During the 900-day siege, an estimated 1.5 million Soviet citizens starved to death. And again, interjecting parenthetically, the Battle of Leningrad was one of the most important and bloodiest battles on the Eastern Front during World War II. And anyone familiar with the history of World War II and the Eastern Front will be well acquainted with the Siege of Leningrad and stunned to see one of the SS, Waffen-SS divisions that was laying siege to Leningrad being honored in a suburban town. Skipping down. At meetings organized by Yefimov, by the way, that's the priest in this particular town, Evgeny Yefimov, capital Y-E-F-I-M-O-V, beginning again. At meetings organized by Yefimov, they spun local people the touching tale, that's the Norwegian Waffen-SS veterans, they spun local people the touching tale of how they were tricked into joining the Waffen-SS, not knowing they were going to the Eastern Front, but believing they were going to fight in Finland. The whole story was nothing but lies. The Norwegians had enlisted in the Waffen-SS voluntarily, had taken an oath of loyalty not to Finland nor to Norway, but to Adolf Hitler himself, and served long prison terms in Norway after the war for their treachery. Indeed, their own magazine, Folk of Land, openly boasts about their heroic fight against Bolshevism to, quote, liberate, unquote, the Russian people. And skipping down again. After listening to Russian psalms, Olaf Kjolberg, K-J-O-L-B-E-R-G, the leader of the Norwegian Legion Committee, formally welcomed the gathering. Yefimov himself unveiled the stone. Afterwards, SS veteran Jürgen K. Hove made a speech and donated the Norwegian flag to the church. That man's name is J-O-R-G-E-N-K and then H-O-V-E. Continuing, the most impressive speaker was Ivan Soxland. The former Norwegian Christian leader gave a short speech that bordered on blasphemy, recalling how the Norwegian Legion said the Lord's Prayer before leaving Norway to fight on the Eastern Front. He recited a blessing to those present. It's ironic that they would have said the Lord's Prayer. Of course, the SS had at its core an anti-Christian and occult religious philosophy that is anything but orthodox in any size, shape, form, or manner. That last fellow's name, by the way, Ivan, E-I-V-I-N-D, Saxland, capital S-A-X-L-U-N-D. Does not mention here whether Ivan Saxland inveighed against Tinky Winky the Teletubby at this particular gathering. Again, a stunning article for anyone familiar with the history of the Eastern Front in the Second World War. One of the Waffen-SS divisions, the Norwegian Legion that laid siege to Leningrad, having a memorial dedicated to it in a town that had been their headquarters during that siege. And again, this particular half-hour segment is a magazine format, so we're going to travel across the Atlantic Ocean and down to the Southern Hemisphere, and we're going to take a look at a potentially very significant and, to some at least, equally nauseating detail concerning the ongoing Brazilian financial crisis. Brazil's currency is under siege, and it remains to be seen whether the Brazilian bailout that the IMF engaged in 1998 takes hold, or whether the Brazilian economy follows those of Asia into the tank. The following article was researched for us by a listener who got this from the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, February 3rd of 1999. This is an article by Jeff Dyer in São Paulo and Richard Waters in New York. It's headlined, Brazil Bank Chief Goes After 3 Weeks. It reads in part, Brazil has changed its central bank president for the second time in less than 3 weeks as the government scrambles to rebuild its credibility after last month's forced devaluation. President Fernando Henrique Cardoso nominated Arminio Fraga, F-R-A-G-A, a former director of the central bank, to be the new president, pending approval by the Senate. Until last week, Mr. Fraga was a managing director of Soros Fund Management, which runs the investment funds of George Soros, the billionaire investor. Of course, Soros' last name, S-O-R-O-S. More about the appointment of Mr. Fraga to head up the Brazilian Central Bank. This is an article also researched for us by that same listener, also from the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, February 3rd of 1999. This is also an article by Jeff Dyer and Richard Waters. It's headlined, Brazil Picks Hedge Fund Poacher as Economic Gamekeeper. It's subheaded, The Nomination as Central Bank Chief of Arminio Fraga, who used to run investment funds for George Soros, is already drawing political fire. The article reads in part, "Few poachers have gone on to tend the game at quite such large estates as Arminio Fraga. Only last week, Mr. Fraga, 42, was a managing director at Soros Fund Management, the company that runs the investment funds of George Soros, the billionaire investor. He used to manage a fund that took bets on macroeconomic changes such as currency devaluations in emerging markets." Note that. "Mr. Soros' company won fame in 1992 when its heavy selling of sterling was held partly responsible for the currency's devaluation. Mr. Soros has also been personally blamed for some of the currency crises in Asia over the last 2 years. Mahathir Mohamad, Prime Minister of Malaysia, was quoted as saying Mr. Soros, quote, is always looking for means to destroy us, unquote. Although Mr. Soros is himself a critic of unfettered capital flows, his investment funds have become one of the most striking symbols of the heavy volatility and frequent currency crises in today's global capital markets." Again, note this, Mr. Soros himself is critical of the very types of assaults on the developments of emerging markets currencies that he and his organization have in many ways been the front runner, or certainly one of the leading players in performing. Reminds me of that famous scene in Casablanca where Major Strasser asks Louis, the police chief, to close down Rick's Cafe, and so Louis says he's shocked to learn that there was gambling going on in this establishment. And then the croupier says, "You're winning, sir." My view on Mr. Soros' critique of the very types of things that he does himself is very similar. Continuing. "Now Mr. Fraga has been nominated the new president of the Brazilian Central Bank, the third since the start of the year, at a time when the world's ninth largest economy is suffering just such a financial crisis." Skipping down. "Mr. Fraga has been brought in with the aim of neutralizing new speculative pressures, stemming the currency's plunge, and preventing inflation from returning with a vengeance. He had been with Soros Fund Management since 1993, after the sterling crisis, and managed the $1.4 billion Quantum Emerging Growth Fund, which suffered the brunt of the hedge fund group's $2 billion losses after the collapse of the Russian ruble last summer." Quote, "He was very actively involved with investment decisions," unquote, said an executive at one large U.S. investment bank that dealt extensively with the Soros funds. Again quoting, "He had a high position in the organization and had direct contact with Soros." And skipping down yet again, "With the political temperature in Brasilia already at boiling point, Mr. Fraga will be stepping into a minefield when he goes before a Senate confirmation hearing on February 22nd after the carnival break. For many on the Brazilian left, Mr. Soros, his former employer, has come to symbolize the excesses of global capitalism that they despise." Quote, "For the last 4 years, his job has been to maximize the profits of a mega fund. Is he the right person to judge how to preserve the stability of the currency?" Unquote, asked Eduardo Suplicy, a senator for the Workers' Party. That senator's name, Eduardo, of course, Eduardo Suplicy, is his last name. So it remains to be seen just what takes place as a result of Mr. Fraga's appointment as head of the Brazilian Central Bank. However, to my eyes, it looks rather like a classic case of appointing a fox to watch the henhouse or a poacher to watch the game preserve, as the Financial Times put it. "For the last several years, I've been accessing work from the landmark text Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by Paul Manning." Paul Manning was part of the CBS News team that covered the war in Europe, along with Edward R. Murrow and Walter Cronkite. He wrote the landmark text about the Bormann Organization, the Bormann Flight Capital Organization. Again, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, published in hardcover by Lyle Stewart and copyright 1981. One of the most important books ever written, in my opinion, and about an organization that I believe, barring a change, will prove to be the decisive element in human affairs on this planet. I also did a two-part interview, both of them altogether spontaneous, with Peter Manning, Paul Manning's son. And Peter was gracious enough to send me some of the correspondence that Paul Manning engaged in with some of the leading executives with major news and entertainment organizations in the wake of the publication of his book. I'd like to read an excerpt from a letter that was written by Paul Manning to William Leonard, the president of CBS News, and this is on November 1st, 1981. This is a letter that touts the book, and in a discussion of the subject material of Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, Paul Manning discusses Heinrich Müller. Heinrich Müller was the head of the Gestapo, and although rumored dead at the end of World War II, in fact he escaped at the end of the war and became the security director for the deadly Bormann organization. That's discussed at considerable length in the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile. That's also discussed in a number of different excerpts of that book that are available from Spitfire. In this particular letter to William Leonard, Paul Manning wrote, and again, kudos to Peter Manning for having bequeathed me some of Paul's correspondence, from some of his father's correspondence. Writing to the president of CBS News, Paul Manning said, "Last week on AM Chicago, I appeared for 30 minutes with Simon Wiesenthal's number one Nazi hunter, who acknowledged on the air with me that Bormann had surely made it out of Berlin to South America, and also agreed that the gray eminence of clandestine affairs was and is General Müller of the Gestapo, who today at 79 is security chief for the Bormann organization, and whose title at present translated is, quote, Minister of the Interior in Exile for the organization, unquote. That, by the way, is as of 1981. There's a miscellaneous archive show entitled The Flight of the Wolf, which not only details Heinrich Müller's work on behalf of U.S. intelligence at the end of World War II, but his arranging for the escape of Adolf Hitler. By the way, it has now been scientifically determined that the remains found in the bunker were neither Adolf Hitler nor Eva Braun, but rather the remains were of a double, a distant relative of Hitler's from the same part of Austria, who was a frequent stand-in for Hitler and who had been dispatched and buried in Hitler's stead by Heinrich Müller and his associates. Next, Paul Manning rather goes on to describe the last time he saw Heinrich Müller, which was in Tripoli. That, of course, is in Libya, and this was when Heinrich Müller was on assignment to build up the Libyan intelligence service for Muammar Gaddafi. Paul Manning writes to William Leonard on November 1st, 1981. Again, William Leonard was the president of CBS News at the time. "I last saw Heinrich Müller in Tripoli, where I was tracing the Nazi connection. Müller was having dinner in the Normandy Hotel with his staff, having been retained for $5 million by Colonel Muammar el-Gaddafi to set up a new intelligence service following the overthrow of King Idris in 1970. Since that time, every Libyan embassy and consulate in the world has security and intelligence provided by men trained in those years by General Müller. It was Müller who discredited Ladislaus Farrago back in 1973. By the way, Ladislaus Farrago, the author of, among other titles, The Game of the Foxes, Burn After Reading, and the book referred to here, Aftermath, in which he tracked down Martin Bormann in Latin America, was fed some disinformation by Heinrich Müller. I still think the book Aftermath is worth reading, but it does have some disinformation in it about Müller's discreditation of Farrago. It was Müller who discredited Ladislaus Farrago back in 1973. The KGB is expert at disinformation, but Müller and his group are far better at it. When I was in West Germany talking with some SS veterans, separately, as always, of the Bormann organization, I was told that Farrago was in South America tracking the Bormann story. The particular man who had provided a safe house for Bormann in the 10 days after the Reichsleiter had escaped from the Führer bunker said to me, quote, but that is okay. General Müller has plans for Farrago. He is not going to have him killed. He will be discredited in the world press. Wait and see," unquote. One of Müller's agents started supplying Farrago with forged documents, then with a snapshot purporting to be of Bormann and an Argentine secret agent at the border of Chile. When it had been displayed in newspapers around the world, Müller next had his agent go to the New York Times bureau chief in Buenos Aires and, quote, reveal, unquote, that the snapshot was of a high school teacher and a companion of his, the picture having been artfully posed against a recognizable school building. This disclosure and the false documents that Farrago had trustingly taken did him in. The effect on journalism and on editors in general was more devastating than that on Farrago himself. The search for the truth in this matter faltered, and the notion that Bormann had been long dead continued to be fostered by Willy Brandt, the CIA, and successive West German governments. I have been told that Müller once explained, quote, the world is a chessboard, and editors are my pawns, unquote. Mueller has been finessing the news media everywhere for 36 years. The journalistic attack on Ladislas Farago in his book Aftermath in the United States was led by a writer who has since become quite well known for launching attacks on generally creditable theses, namely a fellow named Gerald Posner, who has become quite famous in recent years for endorsing the official and altogether untenable orthodoxy with regard to the assassinations of President Kennedy and, more recently, Martin Luther King. Gerald Posner wrote a book called Case Closed, which endorses the nonsense dredged up by the Warren Commission. He has most recently written a book called Killing the Dream, which endorses the official James Earl Ray, the lone nut, did it nonsense with regard to the assassination of Martin Luther King. The earlier attack by Gerald Posner on Ladislas Farago and his book Aftermath is discussed in a book called Unholy Alliance, subtitled A History of Nazi Involvement with the Occult. That book was authored by Peter Levenda, last name L-E-V-E-N-D-A, was published in softcover by Avon Books and copyright 1995. And there's a discussion in this book of Posner's attack on Farago and Aftermath. Levenda writes, "One of the shrillest critics of Farago's work is Gerald L. Posner, whose latest offering, Case Closed, purports to prove, unquote, the Warren Commission's findings that Lee Harvey Oswald acted alone in the assassination of President Kennedy. Posner attacked Farago in a book, co-authored with BBC television producer John Ware, entitled Mengele, The Complete Story. In this work, begun safely 2 years after Mengele's death in Brazil, Farago was needlessly and brutally characterized as an incompetent venal swindler who was duped at every turn in his quest for Mengele, a quest which resulted, says Posner, in the murder of an innocent man wrongly assumed to be Mengele. Incredibly, Posner lays this crime at Farago's door, an ironic leap for someone who criticizes the JFK conspiracy theorists for similar, quote, leaps, unquote. We may be certain that Mr. Posner will provide the reading public with more such proofs in the future in his zealous defense of government-approved cover stories and socially acceptable mythology." By the way, this forecast in 1995 proved altogether prescient, as witnessed by the recent publication by Posner of Killing the Dream. Continuing, "Perhaps a book that will prove that Senator Joe McCarthy's famous list of suspected communists in the U.S. government was genuine, or a study proving that George Bush had nothing at all to do with Iran-Contra." By the way, the attempted resurrection of Joe McCarthy is in full swing. That, again, Peter Levenda's discussion of Gerald Posner's attack on the credibility of Ladislas Farago. In light of some of Posner's other efforts, I don't think it is an altogether unfair question to ask whether when Heinrich Mueller was saying, "The world is a chessboard and editors are my pawns," unquote, Gerald Posner might have been one of those pawns of Heinrich Mueller. Again, that's what I like to call food for thought and grounds for further research. That concludes the main body of this program. Let me give you the address, etc., for Spitfire. That's the tape duplication service that carries the various tapes that I've produced over the years, the archive shows, the various For the Record half-hour segments, the tapes of most of the lectures that I've done, as well as the weekly One Step Beyond shows from my home base station, KFJC-FM. Spitfire can be reached at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. That regular mailing address again, Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. The email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. And I'm happy to report on, as of February 14th, that the vast bulk of the descriptions for the various programs available from Spitfire are now back up on the KFJC webpage. You can access the KFJC webpage at www.kfjc.org. That's www.kfjc.org. We're now using a new web server, so if you have bookmarked that site, you'll have to re-bookmark it. But again, it's www.kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions section and the Public Affairs section under Transmissions. You can also listen to the program on that same website. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.